Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Yemen Without a U.S. Embassy, Now What? I'm J.J. Area, a Web Education and Resources Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Jan H. Brown from New York, New York. Joining Jan is Susan Waller-Ramos from Asheville, North Carolina, and Yaman Salahi, staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus from San Francisco, California. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Jan.
Thank you very much, JJ, and welcome, everybody. You know, as immigration practitioners, we're all familiar with the frustrations of petitioners not being able to get their beneficiaries to the United States in a timely fashion. Unfortunately, now in Yemen, there's also an added overlay of extreme desperation and panic due to the war conditions going on. So today we're going to discuss how we can help our clients to try to survive as best as possible in this very unique and harsh climate. So let's start by talking about finding a post to accept and adjudicate a case, since the embassy in Yemen is out of business for the indefinite future. So, Susan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, initially, U.S. Embassy Cairo and U.S. Embassy Algiers were designated to be the immigrant visa processing posts for Yemeni IV cases. There were issues surrounding Cairo because Egypt required visas, and a lot of folks couldn't get into Cairo in order to process their immigrant visas. So Algiers, the NVC started sending those cases to Algiers on August 31st of 2015. Most recently, a lot of cases are being processed through Djibouti as well. And Djibouti was even at one point accepting petitions, relative petitions, on an emergency basis. So at the moment, Algiers and Djibouti seem to be where a lot of folks are being able to be processed.
If I could elaborate or follow up, everybody, the fact that cases were being scheduled in Cairo and then Egypt imposed a visa requirement on people from Yemen shows the ad hoc nature of the entire system and how the State Department is struggling to cope with a very hostile situation that's totally out of its own control. Fortunately, Algeria is accepting people from Yemen. It's further away, so they're not worried about being flooded with refugees from Yemen. So that's a good thing. In terms of Djibouti, let me just add that in order for Djibouti to accept a case, a person has to physically be present in Djibouti, and that's the beneficiary has to make it to Djibouti either by boat, or if a plane is flying and they can do it by plane, they can then register with the embassy and either stay in Djibouti for however many weeks or months it might take, or leave and come back when the time is ripe. In terms of other locations, it's really ad hoc. The further away you get from Yemen, the easier it might be for someone to convince a consul to take the case. Unfortunately, all of poor Yemen's neighbors don't want to be bothered with all these cases, except for Djibouti, which will do it if people show up, and Algiers, which will do it by edict of the State Department. So that's the situation as far as that goes. So another very unique situation with Yemen is the fact that many United States citizens who were originally born in Yemen have had their U.S. passports seized and revocation proceedings instituted. So, Yaman, you have a lot of experience with that. Would you care to tell us a little about, or a lot about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is a pretty unique issue that involves anti-fraud investigations that were happening at the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a. And the typical scenario was that a Yemeni American citizen, usually somebody who was naturalized or who had citizenship by operation of law, even if they had been born in Yemen, would show up to the embassy to help petition for a beneficiary to obtain a visa or to help a child born in Yemen obtain their first U.S. passport or a consular report of birth abroad. And what happened at that point, and there are cases going back to 2012, but a lot of them are concentrated in 2013. What happened at that point is that a number of people were taken into interrogation rooms in the embassy compound and held for several hours, sometimes up to a full day, by a diplomatic security service officer who coerced confessions from these people that they had committed some sort of immigration fraud, that they or their parents had committed some sort of immigration fraud or identity fraud to make a claim of citizenship or to obtain a U.S. visa. The nature of the fraud typically has to do with the names. So in a lot of cases, the confessions purport to state that the individual used a false name to obtain an immigration benefit. And these are cases that go back decades. So, for example, one of our clients has been living in the United States since 1972 and has been a citizen, a naturalized citizen, since 1978. And so what happened at the embassy was that after these folks signed these confessions, often under the false promise that once they signed, their U.S. passports would be returned to them or their children's documentation would be provided to them, their passports were actually unilaterally seized by the embassy. Under the law, under statute and under department regulations, a U.S. passport can't be revoked without the individual being provided with written notice and an opportunity for a prompt post-revocation hearing. Yet in these cases, no such notice was provided. And in fact, a lot of these people were simply ignored while they were in Yemen, repeatedly contacting the embassy, asking for assistance to return to the U.S. and so on. So in effect, what was happening was this de facto banishment and denaturalization through the confiscation of passports by taking away the means that people had to return to the U.S., to their homes, to their families, or to their jobs. At some point in late 2013, the State Department began to issue notices of revocation to folks whose passports had previously been confiscated. And the allegation was that the department had revoked the passports on the basis that the passports were obtained fraudulently because the individuals used a false name, i.e. the name on their certificate of naturalization or their certificate of citizenship, to obtain the passports. And a couple months after that, in early 2014, the embassy started to provide people with what's called a limited validity passport, which was just a one-way travel document so that they could return to the U.S. And so where we are today is that a lot of those folks who have come back to the U.S. Are contesting the revocation of their passports either through administrative hearings or in litigation, which is a stage where we at the Asian Law Caucus are at today.
Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. And so what we are concerned with here, there are a number of issues with the passport revocation process overall, but what's most concerning is that it looks like the State Department is essentially mounting these collateral attacks on the citizenship of Yemeni Americans through this argument that their passports are fraudulently procured because, as the State Department alleges, their citizenship was fraudulently procured. But normally, citizenship is protected unless the government has gone through the requisite process and met its very high burden to denaturalize somebody. But the State Department is trying to bypass that process. And what we've seen in these cases is that this has been extremely prejudicial to those people who've been affected because, in effect, the State Department has taken away their right to travel and their right to travel back to the U.S. With no process whatsoever because they only offer a post-revocation administrative hearing. And at those administrative hearings, the sole piece of evidence on which the State Department has relied and on which it sustained its findings have been those confessions that were signed at the U.S. Embassy. There have been a number of other concerns that the folks have raised about these hearings as well. That includes the, you know, and I think, Jane, you've dealt with a few of these cases as well, but the procedures are just comically short of anything you'd expect in a proceeding of this nature where somebody's citizenship is at stake, effectively.
Absolutely.
So in our lawsuit, we've raised three main theories under the Administrative Procedure Act. One has been that the statements which form the basis for the revocation action were procured involuntarily and therefore in violation of the Fifth Amendment, because despite the individuals coming forward at the hearings and saying that, describing the circumstances under which they signed the confessions, the State Department made no effort whatsoever to rebut their claims. For example, they didn't bring in agents to say that's not what happened or introduce any other evidence into the record to undermine the credibility of the individuals. The second theory has been that the State Department should be obligated to meet its burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence rather than a mere preponderance of the evidence. This process is so novel and so chaotic at the State Department now that at our hearing, the hearing officer and the State Department attorney both actually said that they didn't believe that any burden of proof applied whatsoever because it was an informal hearing, which was a point that the judge in our case did not receive very warmly. But the third theory, which I think is the most important one, is that this kind of revocation is outside the department's statutory authority because it intrudes upon the very established scheme that Congress has created to protect naturalized citizens from attacks on their citizenship except through denaturalization procedures.
You know, if I can observe, it again seems to me that this whole idea of seizing and revoking passports of U.S. citizens came out of Sana'a, Yemen, as a, you know, as the brainchild of some people over there. And from my observation, as it developed, the State Department kind of was running after the people over there to try to figure out how to implement procedures to give it a gloss of legitimacy and due process that it didn't have for such a long time, while the people in Sana'a, in the embassy, were going about their business of interrogating people and concluding that their passports should be seized. It's another example of how the people from Yemen get such short shift when they are dealing with the U.S. Embassy over there, unfortunately. Which brings me to another related topic, which is there are no documents in Yemen that have been in the past created contemporaneously with an event such as a birth, a marriage, or a death, which means that Yemen has always been considered a high fraud post. And as such, the people in the State Department who work at the post are always very suspicious of anything that is presented to them because not being the most advanced of countries in terms of paperwork, documentation just doesn't exist and is created through the affidavits of witnesses who swear before a court that yes, so-and-so was married on a certain day, or yes, so-and-so was born on a certain day. And since the embassy has always had this attitude of suspicion, it wasn't a great leap to start looking at the passports of people who are U.S. citizens who were born in Yemen to try to deconstruct how they got them in this harsh 9/11, post 9/11 world. So I'm just giving what I see as almost a philosophic overview of how we got to this position where the American Civil Liberties Union had to send out a warning to American citizens not to go to the embassy in Yemen if they were born there because they were at their own peril. It's indeed a very terrible situation on top of the terrible situation of the disintegration of the entire country. One other topic that we should talk about is how to get a case expedited, because as I indicated in my opening remarks, people are panicked, people are desperate to get their families out of Yemen. And, you know, the State Department has come up with procedures how to get cases expedited through, if you can show a humanitarian or emergency need. I've done a little research on how to do that. I don't know, Susan, if you have anything on that. Otherwise, I will talk about it.
Yeah, well, just that, you know, it really, State Department really does want that to involve a life or death medical emergency is what I've found. And I haven't had one of these in a couple of years, but I remember it being a very strict process, and we really did have to show evidence of the medical emergency. And the NBC currently has information regarding expedited on its website, which says at the moment, you know, they really want a letter from a physician or a medical facility, including all of that contact information, and the statement has to declare that a life or death emergency does exist. So it seems to be a very a high threshold that must be met. But as I said, I haven't had to do that in a couple of years. Jan, I think you've had a more recent experience, if I'm not mistaken, with that.
Yeah, I was able to come up with pictures of my client's apartment showing the windows had been blown out and relatives had been killed in the bombings. So while that's not a medical emergency in terms of the health of somebody, it is an emergency in terms of their
life
social
or death,
health, as it were. The hard part, I think, is to show that a bomb has fallen on your head as opposed to three blocks away. Most of this bombing is somewhat random. It might be aimed at a neighborhood so that it wouldn't never qualify for political asylum per se just on that basis. But if it's come close enough, you have a shot at getting the case expedited because, people are so desperate to protect their families, and I consider that there's untold thousands of refugees from Yemen and other countries that are just not called refugees because they're afraid to go back, but they're not admitted as refugees or recognized in other countries, so they're basically paying rent apartments in other countries and fending for themselves as best they can. It's a situation that is very untenable, but real. And as I indicated, the neighboring countries don't exactly go out of their way to accommodate people from Yemen in their time of dire need. So, This is the situation that we have. There is a procedure that is also very difficult, which is to direct file an I-130 through a consular office. So, Susan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, it is difficult. As most practitioners know, beginning August 15th of 2011, petitioners who were residing outside of the United States were no longer able to file forms I-130 with the post. So now, unless a post has a USCIS office, a local USCIS office, the general rule is you have to file your I-130 with the Chicago lockbox in the United States. as opposed to walking up to a counter and doing it. Now, there are some exceptions to that. USCIS will authorize State Department to adjudicate I-130s in what they call certain emergency situations. And they have those listed on their website, but I can briefly say what they are. One is when a U.S. service member stationed overseas becomes aware of a new deployment or transfer, a petitioner or beneficiary is facing an urgent medical emergency that requires immediate travel, a petitioner or beneficiary is facing an imminent threat to personal safety, a beneficiary is within a few months of aging out, the petitioner and family have traveled for the immigrant visa interview, but petitioner has naturalized and the family now requires a standalone petition, and the petitioner has adopted a child and there's an imminent need to leave the country. Those are the circumstances that USCIS deems emergency enough to consider on a case-by-case basis whether it will allow the State Department to adjudicate an I-130. Now, I mentioned earlier that Djibouti was accepting these relative petitions for U.S. citizens at one time, and they consider that an emergency filing procedure. We asked the State Department in our October liaison meeting if they would consider continuing to do that, and they said they really couldn't do that, that it was an emergency procedure, and continuing to do that limited their ability to process immigrant visas. And so they would only accept the filing on case-by-case basis for cases that met the emergency threshold.
Yeah, I think what happened is that Djibouti just got overwhelmed, and I suppose they could have assigned more personnel there. I don't know what the staffing is in Djibouti. It was and still is, for many people, the only bright spot in terms of getting out of Dodge, so to speak, and finding a safe haven. But as time has gone on, it's become less and less a post where things happen quickly. Although I think they still go more quickly than perhaps waiting to be scheduled in a place like Algiers. But nothing is fast enough when your family is in danger of getting blown up.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot that we can do about that, other than I do tell people if they manage to get to another country to knock on the door and try to convince them to take the case, and not too many people have been successful. And I found that some people have made it as far away as Malaysia, and for a while a couple of people were getting their cases adjudicated there, but then they stopped because they didn't want a flood of people coming to Malaysia. So it's the same problem that is existent in every alternate possible post. So I think we've touched upon the topics we wanted to talk upon. Does anybody have any other thoughts that they'd like to discuss before we say goodbye to everybody?
I would like to add one additional point, which is that with the Yemeni American population in particular, there are a lot of people with young children who are born abroad who would be entitled to U.S. citizenship but have not gone through the normal paperwork, so they don't need to file a petition for an immigration visa or anything. And the one piece of information that I've gotten from the State Department is that folks in that situation can appear at any U.S. consulate to obtain a passport to travel to the U.S., even if they're first-time passport applicants. So we've had a couple of clients who've appeared at the U.S. Embassy in Amman, Jordan, for example, to obtain the documentation necessary to leave and travel to the U.S. as U.S. citizens, even if they haven't previously been here.
Have you seen, Iman, any examples of children whose cases have been delayed because their father's passports have been revoked or citizenship is therefore in question, so the post drags its feet on whether to recognize the U.S. citizenship of the child?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's one of the major consequences of this passport revocation program, is that it not only stranded the citizen principals abroad, but it also put the cases of their children and others on ice while this was pending. But oddly enough, and this is one reason I think that this revocation program has been ill thought out, we have gotten confirmation from the State Department regarding one of our clients whose passport was revoked that, notwithstanding the revocation of his passport, they do recognize the citizenship of one of his children who was born abroad but hasn't yet obtained the necessary paperwork. So they have indicated that were that child to appear at any U.S. posts around the world, that post would be able to issue a limited validity passport or other documentation to enable her to travel to the U.S.
Well, that's the best news we've discussed all day here. I'm at least happy for that.
Well, yes, I think there are some logistical difficulties there, though, because one benefit is this person has actually already submitted a DNA test, and so there is conclusive proof. But if you don't have that kind of proof, then you go back to the problem, Jan, that you were discussing earlier, where the embassy seems to treat all those petitions as fraudulent until proven otherwise.
And, of course, in terms of DNA tests, when they can't be done in Yemen anymore, there's no embassy there to gather the proof, so it's a very inconvenient process for someone to have to go to another country to make an appointment at an embassy to have the DNA sample taken there and then to wait until the results come in. But it's just the privations that people from a country that doesn't exist anymore have to go through. Anyway, I think that we can wrap up. Thank you both, and thank you everybody for listening, and thank you for joining us out there in podcast land, and this concludes our podcast.